Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name's Christine Burns, as just said. And as it says in the biography material with your packs, I start by explaining that I'm a transsexual woman. If we're going to talk about the gender duty and its relationship to transgender people, then I think we have to do a little bit of gender 101 first. I think most of the other speakers have probably actually had the advantage that we all come in here with at least some preconceptions or conceptions about what are the issues in terms of equality for both women and men. I doubt very much that there's many of you in the audience who really know much about transgender people. Let's just do a quick poll first. Could you put your hands up if you either know a trans person, that's a transsexual or a transgender person, or even somebody who cross-dresses, or somebody who's got an intersex background, if you know somebody, or even know somebody who knows somebody? Well, actually, that's not bad, and it's quite commonplace that that when I speak to people, at least we've got that degree of understanding. I'm not going to go further this afternoon to ask whether that's a colleague or a friend or a friend of a friend or whatever, or somebody you've seen on Big Brother, but it just shows actually that although trans people are supposed to be incredibly rare in society, a good 70 to 80% of you just put your hands up. So we're there all the time. And of course, there's also the question of actually how many trans people have you sat next to on the train? Have you had an ambulance? Have you met in a meeting and never realised it? And I think it's very helpful, actually, if we do a little exercise. I call this a little parlour game, and I do it with everybody I speak to. I'd like you to think of somebody you know fairly well. Not intimately well, so we're going to rule out children of yours and we're going to rule out partners. I usually say to journalists, think of your editor. To politicians, I ask them to think about the Prime Minister. In your case, I suppose the Chief Executive, perhaps. Now, I take it you can also put a gender on that person. Is it a man or a woman? Okay. But have you ever seen their genitals? And are you ever likely to? Probably not. And the point of that exercise, as simple as it may seem, is to underline the point that actually gender isn't about what's between your legs. That only matters if you're actually planning on having sex with somebody. And then perhaps it's valid to inquire or to take an interest in that. Otherwise, it's not your business to know what's between my legs, and I won't ask you either. But that actually is an important lesson because it helps to read and understand what I'm going to tell you about next. Tyra Hunter, again, going back to our little exercise, I don't think you'd actually have any difficulty in recognising that Tyra is a woman. She was on her way to something as a passenger in somebody's car when it was hit from the side by a hit-and-run driver. She was very badly injured. By the time the emergency services arrived, people had removed her from the car, and the personnel obviously started attending to her. And, of course, as part of that, because she was bleeding very badly, they started to remove her clothes. And the emergency worker on the scene noticed that she had a penis. And at that point, he withdrew, and he started laughing at Tyra, who was then, at that point, bleeding to death on the pavement, and saying some rather objectionable things. And although she didn't die on the pavement, she died very shortly after in hospital in an avoidable fashion. On December the 11th, 1998, a jury awarded Tyra's mother, Margie Hunter, $2.8 million after finding the District of Columbia guilty of negligence and malpractice. While $500,000 of the amount was awarded for damages attributed to the withdrawal of medical care at the accident scene, a further $1.5 million was for conscious pain and suffering endured by Tyra in the emergency room as a result of medical malpractice. Now, I think we can all be fairly confident, we hope, that that would never happen in the United Kingdom. But actually, let's see what how Britain is today. First thing is that I'm going to explain my terminology a little bit later, but to start with, I'm going to talk about transsexual people. That is, people who are defined by a medical process that involves hormones and involves probably surgery to permanently alter their primary and secondary sex characteristics. And the government and ourselves have pretty now agreed in the estimate there are about 5,000 transsexual people in the UK. There are far more transgendered people. In fact, I was discussing at lunch, we really don't know actually how many, but that gives you an idea of the scale. And also, since 1999, it has been unlawful not to treat gender dysphoric people on the NHS, although there are still some PCTs who attempt to get away with it. In the last few months, we've been very fortunate in obtaining some money from the Equalities Review under Trevor Phillips, which enabled us to carry out the first quality research of its kind in the United Kingdom. We managed to poll 870 transgender and transsexual people overall, and we put them through a questionnaire online that took about an hour to fill in, 129 separate questions. And out of the analysis of that data, we found that 6.3% of those surveyed, and bear in mind we're talking about a pretty significant sample of what we think the population is, 6.3% said they had actually been refused medical treatment. This weekend I was contacted by a trans woman who actually said that she was looking for a journalist who might be sympathetic to her tale because she'd just exhausted every GP in her area. She'd been removed from all of their lists. Nobody wanted to treat her. So she can't get a GP anywhere near where she lives. For most people it's not that bad, but still 19.5% of those who were surveyed said that they felt their treatment had been adversely affected because of health staff knowing about their trans background. That's either because it was obvious, because they, to use the parlance, they don't pass, or because somebody had communicated that information, maybe through inappropriate information being contained in medical records being passed on. And I'll give you an anecdote. A colleague of mine in the campaign was referred last year for a serious problem with her knee, and the first three paragraphs of the introductory letter from her GP spent time discussing her gender background. It's only in the last paragraph of the letter that he finally remembered that she was supposed to be being referred for a problem with her knee. On top of those 20% or so, fortunately 60% of people report that they're GPs, and when I'm talking about GPs, I think we can probably induct this to include other health service personnel as well, would like to help them, but actually said they didn't know how to because they'd never had any training and they couldn't find any. It's only a 20%, one-fifth of the population, who actually said that they felt satisfied that they were properly respected and competently treated by their healthcare professionals. And I think that's an awful indictment on a service that is built around the concept of care, particularly when 6.3% of people are saying that publicly funded employees who are there to provide care for every citizen of the United Kingdom without fear or favour on the grounds of gender, on the grounds of colour, on the grounds of religion or anything else, that they can actually decide that they're going to say, I'm not going to treat you. I think that's reprehensible, and the sooner we stamp it out the better. And just to underline why it's important, that same survey also pointed out that 34.4% of the people we surveyed said that at some point in their life before they received treatment for their gender condition had considered suicide or self-harm once or in some cases twice or more times. A few weeks ago I dealt with somebody in Wales who actually attempted to commit suicide, sending an email out to everybody just before she'd finished taking all the tablets. We had no way of contacting her, and it wasn't until 24 hours later that we found out that by sheer luck that somebody had actually been logged in at that time of night and received her message and got the ambulance to turn up, bash down the door and actually save her life. Now she's receiving treatment belatedly. But how many people have to die to actually change policy in that way? Carrying on with our statistics, according to the Minister, for the last year in which figures were available, the NHS carried out 100 gender reassignment surgeries. Although our estimates are that In fact, there's about 200 people start transitioning and finish transitioning each year. The other 100 actually find the NHS serves them so badly that they would prefer to sell their house. They would prefer even to consider going into prostitution in order to be able to go abroad for service where they will be treated with respect. And actually, they will probably get a better service as well. It's remarkable that people go to Thailand, spend half as much as it costs the NHS to treat somebody, and come back with glowing praise for the service that they've actually experienced and think it's great. Well, it's lovely to have a holiday in Thailand, but actually I prefer, you know, that people weren't having to do it in those circumstances. I repeat, the NHS is for everybody, not just for half the people. One thing we have found, by the way, this isn't about money. The research we're now doing is actually uncovering that because this is an area that's been so neglected for 50 years, a lot of malpractice has crept in, and a lot of PCTs are simply signing blank checks to a few gender identity clinics who are coining it in and not providing a very good service. We found disparities of 100% in the pricing. In other words, that PCTs could be referring to another centre who provides better service, quicker service as well, for half the price. So actually, we could double the number of people we treat on the NHS without actually even shifting the figures. But in fact, even then, the figures for the current rates for treating 200 people a year works out to around about £2 million. The NHS budget is around about £50 billion. So we're talking about 1/25,000th part of the budget to treat a group of people who collectively represent 1 in 11,500 of the population. So it's not exactly being greedy to actually say we'd like our fair share of the treatment. Fortunately, a lot of things are getting a lot better. I mentioned that when I first started campaigning openly, I could still be sacked without any recompense whatsoever. Nobody had to give an explanation. It was sufficient, you're transsexual, we don't want you in our company. But even though we actually managed to change that only 8 years ago, in 1999, 62% of transsexual people are still reporting that they felt they needed to change their jobs after they had transitioned. And the reasons are many-fold, but generally speaking, they're to do with the atmosphere in their place of work, the feeling that because everybody knows their background, they felt harassed and pressured into moving on, trying to make a new life where nobody knows of their background. And if we only achieve equality by keeping it that secret, our background, that's no kind of equality whatsoever. That's no security, because tomorrow it could all be lost. And the government actually hasn't been all that fast. I need to explain that although, of course, the gender equality duty includes transgender men and women in the same way as all men and women, actually, in practice, it only covers transsexual people, that is, people who are defined as planning to undergo, undergoing, or having undergone gender reassignment, and it only covers them for Parts 1 and 2 of the Sex Discrimination Act at the moment. So we have protection in employment and in vocational education, but although we're about to see the enactment of the Goods and Services Regulations for lesbian, gay and bisexual people, we're actually going to have to wait probably until the 11th hour, when the government has no further choice on the 21st of December 2007 in order to implement the Gender Equality Directive in full, which means that they must have legislation in place by that point in order to cover trans people. But again, that minimalist approach applies, that actually your rights are defined in terms of that planning to undergo, undergoing, or having undergone gender reassignment. There's nothing in that legislation that actually inherently protects people simply on the basis of how they present to the world. And that's quite important, because that affects everybody. Because if somebody else judges that you don't look male enough or female enough and discriminates against you, then we're unable to help you with our legislation, unfortunately. And there's an awful lot of people in that position. We want to get away from the idea that being trans is all about hacking off genitals or sticking them on. It's not. It's about identity. For some people, part of that identity does relate to actually what's between their legs and what's stuck on their chest and all the other bits and pieces as well. But for other people, it's not. It's simply about the ability to actually live freely in society as who they feel themselves to be. When people change their appearance and put forward their identity, they're doing it to enable other people to understand what sort of person they are and being actually able to live their lives honestly rather than, again, trying to keep their real feelings under wraps. So just to mop up on the legislation today, because this is the underlying substrate for what we're going to do in terms of gender equality, the Sex Discrimination Gender Reassignment Regulations of 1999, they modified the original Sex Discrimination Act to provide that protection I've just said for people who are undergoing, planning to undergo or having undergone gender reassignment. There was also a Court of Appeal case in 1999 between three trans women called only A, D and G versus what was then Northwest Lancs Health Authority. Because that's a Court of Appeal decision, it has entered the law as case law and it affects what everybody does. And what that held was that it was unlawful for any health authority, for which now read PCT, to operate a policy which amounted to a blanket ban on treatment of any kind for transsexual people. And I say of any kind because, of course, again, everybody presumes that this is purely about being sent to find a surgeon to alter your anatomy. It is actually their case was simply about being able to be referred somewhere so that people could find out what their gender identity was and actually help them feel at peace, avoid them becoming one of those 34.4% suicide statistics. The Gender Recognition Act in 2004, that's the biggie. It took five attempts at going through the European Court of Human Rights to win and then compel the government to enact a piece of legislation which it was really scared about implementing, but when it came to the crunch, it was incredibly easy to do with a little bit of professional assistance from us. The Gender Recognition Act enables people to apply on the basis that they have permanently changed their gender identity and intend to live that way forever, to have that gender identity legally recognised. It means that as a woman, I can now marry a man, rather than for the last umpteen years the government insisting it was perfectly happy for me to marry another woman. It also, and this is perhaps very important to trusts, is that it gives people who have actually been through that process or people who are applying in that process really, really tough protection for their privacy. We recognise that there are times when trans people, no matter how long it is since they transitioned, will need to disclose details of their past. It can happen in employment because you may have to disclose medical treatments you've undergone in the past or maybe actually explain why you're having HRT now. And it can obviously arise in contact with medical professionals as well. What the law actually does is to say that that's fine, we expect trans people to do that, but in return for that, as a quid pro quo, we go out of our way as a society to help protect that person's privacy. So it becomes a criminal offence with a fine of up to £5,000 and a criminal record if you, having received that information from a trans person in carrying out your official duties, pass that information on to anybody else without consent. And it has to be explicit consent. You can't assume that the person didn't mind. And it means that you have to look at how you keep records, because if those records could be opened in a filing cabinet and read by somebody else, then you're failing in that duty. Certainly it covers going outside of the office and saying, you never guess what I met this afternoon. Do you know that Jones woman? You know, she used to be a man. Now, that's actually going to get you into court. And I hate doing it, giving people advice on how to call the police and how to get them to go around and take statements and how to prefer charges. But if that's what it takes to protect people's privacy, then that's unfortunately what we need to do. And we don't really want it to happen to health professionals because it needn't. And as I explained before, of course, we've also got the Goods and Services Regulations, which will appear sometime this year when the government finally gets around to it as a Christmas present. I've alluded to the fact that trans people come in sort of lots of shapes and sizes. Transsexual people, I've explained, that's a medical term, and it describes people who actually are going to go through a process that involves gender reassignment. Transgender people are part of a wider definition of people who define their gender identity and explain it to others without necessarily wanting to undergo surgery. And then, of course, because gender is really a continuum of experiences, we don't exclude the existence of people who simply cross-dress on occasion. For whatever reason, they might do that. And they are, you know, they're very incredibly common. We don't actually know how many there are, but estimates vary between 1 in 20 and 1 in 100 of the population. So probably a fair chance that there's somebody in here. But certainly you probably work with quite a few people who cross-dress at some point. And they're probably very scared of anybody ever knowing because of the consequences that contains. So although the law isn't actually at the moment written in terms of protecting them, you've actually got to ask yourself when you do a gender equality scheme, what are you actually aiming to do? Are you simply aiming to abide by the letter of the law and look for the minimum you need to do in order to avoid getting prosecuted? Or are you going to do it properly and say, what is the principle at stake here? It's a general principle, of course, of equality. How can you do anything to do with equality if you don't include everybody? It's so fundamental. It's indivisible. If you believe in equality, you believe in equality for everybody. Some nice pieces of terminology, though. These days, you wouldn't look at somebody and call them a black. You wouldn't refer to the disabled or the old. Or, generally speaking, you wouldn't generally refer to people by their condition. It's only surgeons who do that. You know, they'll look over, oh, that perforated ulcer over there. Well, in polite society, we don't do that. And so, likewise, most trans people don't like being called a transsexual. It begs the question, a transsexual what? A transsexual goldfish? Or a transgender or anything? It's okay to perhaps call somebody a transsexual person or a transsexual woman, or even a transsexual lesbian woman, or all the other permutations. See what happens when you use adjectives. You don't preclude the possibility of describing other factors about an individual. And you don't actually define somebody in terms of their history and their condition. You look at the important word in transsexual person is person. You can lop off the transsexual and you've still got the person. Also, one of the reasons why people are sensitive about the language is because although gender identity obviously tends to involve sex, although as we established at the outset, for most of us our gender identity doesn't actually depend on people knowing what's between our legs this afternoon. I'll trust you, you know, in terms of how you present. It's not about sexuality. Trans people can be straight, they can be lesbian, they can be homosexual, they can be gay men, they can be bisexual, they can be asexual. Anything indeed. In fact, the comparison is that your sexuality is something that you may only actually really use in very small parts of the day, maybe 3 or 4 minutes in the day if you're particularly unlucky. But your identity is something you express to people everywhere you go. I'm doing it now to you. You're doing it to me. We do it our lifelong. So gender identity, the thing that we go through all this for, isn't about having sex in a particular way or with particular people. So that's why we use trans, because it's a nice, simple word without any baggage. It doesn't actually have that word sexual in, which gets people worried, and it's practically impossible to use it as a noun as well. And I'm going to have to speed up, because now I'm getting behind. We appear in every culture. It's often assumed that trans people are an invention of the last 30 years in corrupt Western society. Well, I have news for you. We're everywhere and throughout time as well. There are cultures in society where there are not just two genders. In one culture, there are 7 genders. God knows how you organise a date in those circumstances, but we cross all economic and class boundaries. There are poor trans people. There are incredibly rich trans people. We're not just about people going from male to female. There's an incredible body of people who've gone from female to male. Remember, we call those trans men. And they've gone from complete invisibility as little as 5 or 6 years ago. I remember in 1993 reading an article in The Guardian where somebody declared that trans men couldn't possibly exist, because what woman would want to do that? But except for very superficial reasons, perhaps, that we're actually talking about dismantling today. But in fact, the numbers are very much closer to parity than people imagine. And trans men are really getting a voice for themselves now. They don't seem to be hampered in the same way as many trans women by appearance or by voice or some of the other factors that often hold back trans women. They've got themselves an identity, and they're going to go out there and they're going to use all that testosterone to make sure that they're heard. We're not sick. We're not defective. We're not mentally ill. For God's sake, we're just different. If I've got a mental illness, then actually I'm quite happy with it, because I never felt so empowered in my life as when I finally started being me all those years ago and then brought the rest of the world round to my way of thinking. We're simply a part of natural variation. And most of us want nothing more than to be ourselves in peace, to be able to enjoy our lives like everybody else. We don't want to ram our gender identity down your throats. The very opposite. That's why campaigning for that privacy in the Gender Recognition Act was so vitally important. But one thing we do need, and this is rather different from being a gay or lesbian person, because if you want to express your identity as a gay or lesbian person, then all you've got to do is find somebody else of the same, you know, with the same state of mind. If you're a trans person, and if you're a trans person of the kind who actually needs some assistance to transform your outer body so that people can understand that you're a woman and not a man, then you're going to need some help from medicine. And you could actually, politically, I suppose you could compare it to the status of pregnancy. You know, having a baby is not an illness, in spite of the fact that generations of doctors behaved as if it was. But although it's not an illness, pregnant women do need the assistance of all parts of the health service to have a healthy and successful pregnancy and bring healthy babies into the world. I think that underlines the point actually, that really trans people's problems are fundamentally a social, not a medical condition. And actually being able to express your identity, being able to stand up and say, look, I'm a trans person, and actually that gives me some fantastic experiences to share with the rest of you. No matter how long the rest of you may live, you will have only ever experienced half of what it is to be a human being. Now, I'm afraid I've not had babies. There were one or two things that I've not done, but then again, some of you haven't done all the things that are actually the options available to you because of what's between your legs. But I've experienced a great deal of what it is to be a covert member of one gender and an out and proud member of the other. And actually, I prefer being this one. But for all that, because I've spent years actually getting into that position, for people who actually go through that transition, it's very stressful and people need support. After all, it's the biggest change anyone can make. Have you ever seen any of those television programmes where people make a complete hash of trying to do it? It's not easy if you're not trans. If you are trans, at least it's easy because it comes naturally. Because all you're doing is being who you are already. You're just trying to help other people recognise that that's the case. But most people, many people still these days, in that process, they lose their jobs, they lose their friends, they lose access to their family, and because of that, they may lose their homes. And actually, they lose all of those things, perhaps in one go, in the space of one day, simply by explaining who they are. Now, we explain usually that if people actually just experience two of those traumas together, they're probably going to experience clinical depression. I've just discussed four, and it's quite commonplace for transsexual people to do that. So if you encounter transsexual people who are experiencing stress, then it's actually not because they're transsexual, but because going through that transition without the support of everybody around you, saying, yeah, come on, I'll help you, I'll show you, you know, how to do your lipstick and things like that, just like, you know, your girlfriends did when you were 12 or 13, and you got it wrong, because that's every little girl's privilege to get it wrong. Somehow or other, we seem to assume that transsexual women must know how to get it right straight away without any help, otherwise they can't possibly be women. The way in which trans people are treated by medicine is one of the most bizarre things imaginable. We don't treat people with care and compassion. What we do is say, well, you know, I don't really believe in this stuff, but if you're really serious, before we're actually refer you to a surgeon. We're going to really put you through an ordeal, an endurance test. If you survive the endurance test, I'll write you a letter to see a surgeon. If not, well, you weren't trans to start with. And that's what we call, in posh terminology, a real life experience. Well, I'll tell you one thing, it's really an experience. It actually compels people to go into their place of work the next day, having changed their gender appearance, and having been told by a psychiatrist that they've got to do that for 3 months before they will even consider prescribing hormones to help them on the way. Hormones which might, for instance, help to, in the process of beginning to remove the facial hair on somebody who's going from male to female. Because if you don't do something to help stop that process going on, then all the money you throw at the process of removing the hair is just money straight down the drain. And it's extremely painful and takes many hundreds of hours to do. Many people experience harassment on a virtually daily basis. And many people are isolated as a result. If you've lost your family, if you've lost your friends, now who do you turn to when it's been a really awful day? And actually the hormones themselves, they can create some short-term emotional turmoil as well. So that transition, you know, it's not for wimps. It requires immense emotional strength. In fact, it requires a characteristic very commonly associated with women to do it successfully. Let's look at a few faces. I know I'm getting behind now, so I'm going to go very fast. I do want to stress that trans people actually work in all sorts of fields. I love this one of the woman who flies a 767 for a living. You know, there are still people in the world who would get nervous enough about the idea that it was a woman sitting in the pilot seat. The idea that it's a trans woman sitting in the pilot seat, God help us. So how does the gender equality duty apply? Well, one of the most important things to grasp is we are not, as in some people's writing of this, men, women and trans people, as though we're a third kind of sex, an add-on, something apart from men and women. We're actually, we do live in a world that's organised around two genders, even though that's wrong. But we have to find our place within that. That's actually what helping somebody to transition is about, to find a comfortable place within a system in which the fact of your reality actually bucks the system. It's much nicer to say there are men and women, including trans men and women. And if you include that within your policies, then we're actually off to a really good start. It applies across everything that you do as a trust. It applies in recruitment and thinking, how could the way in which we word our recruitment actually indirectly put trans people off applying? It applies to retaining existing staff. You know, if you've taken all that money to train a paramedic, wouldn't it be a good idea to try and hang on to them if they're transitioning rather than to let them go? It obviously including trans people as stakeholders throughout services as well, and of course as service users and treating them professionally. So what does that mean? Well, in recruitment, we've actually got some guidance on how to do monitoring of trans people on the front of the Press for Change website, and I do recommend that you go there, www.pfc.org.uk, because you'll find it there. And because the trouble is, you've got to do it very carefully, because imagine that trans people are actually quite rare within an organisation. So if you actually say in your statistics there's a trans woman working within accounts and there's only 3 or 4 people working in accounts, then you know, everybody's going to be looking at each other, and you've probably outed that person unintentionally. It can be done, though. And it's important, I think, that we do start to get into a world where we do start to count and realise that trans people are out there, particularly as service users. You can design application forms in ways that don't threaten to out people. You know, application forms these days often ask for people's former names. Well, why do you want to do that? I can understand why the Criminal Records Bureau wants to do that, and we've got a solution to that with the Criminal Records Bureau. But unless you've got a very good reason for doing it, think about it. And actually, this doesn't only apply to trans people, but supposing somebody has been, in the past, the recipient of domestic violence, and they've moved away, and they're actually trying to lose their past, like trans women do, then, you know, setting out an application form that compels people, on pain of being told that they've been deceitful, to give that information unnecessarily is rather stupid. You can also communicate, obviously, through advertising that the organisation takes trans people's rights and sensitivities seriously. Good point about monitoring is that it's better before wading into monitoring to actually have policies in place first. Because if people can actually read and see that the organisation really is serious about why it wants to know whether it's got any trans people, then people are more likely to feel confident that they can disclose that information rather than expecting that they're going to disclose it anyway. And that, of course, applies also to monitoring of LGB as well. I'm running slow, so there are special CRB procedures. What it means is that there's a very simple way that if somebody needs to apply for Criminal Records Bureau disclosure, then they can do so in a way that doesn't require them to put the information on the disclosure form that's signed by the registered officer, provided what they do is they take a note of the registration number on the application form and send the missing information straight away to a particular address within the Bureau the same day. So they don't have to show it to the member of staff who's going to countersign and check their application, but the Criminal Records Bureau will still get the information. And as I've explained already, it's about understanding what the real implications are of Section 22 of the Gender Recognition Act, because if you don't understand them, we're going to have people with the police coming round and arresting them. It's very important to think about how you are going to support staff when they transition on the job. Now, again, I'm not going to go into that in depth today because it's a whole subject in its own right, but it's better to actually have some thought about it before it happens rather than actually being caught on the back foot when it does. It's important to make sure that it's a supportive environment where people can feel that they are being supported if they experience harassment and discrimination, either from colleagues or, of course, members of the public. And actually, it means being grown up about going to the toilet. I'd say grown up because the hysteria, whenever I give longer lectures about retaining people at work, this is the number one subject that always comes up. It really exercises people's minds. Remember back to Tyra Hunter. Society doesn't need protecting from trans people. Trans people need protecting from society. And that means that if anybody's vulnerable in the ladies' loo, it's going to be a trans woman who's just transitioning and knows everybody knows her past. It's not going to be the women who regard it as a state of right to be able to go in there and have a crafty fag and a long conversation about their colleagues. Because that's not what the premises are provided for by the employer. There's also, in terms of service quality, understanding the dimensions in which even a rudimentary understanding of trans people can lead to better experiences. For instance, the physiological. It's surprising how many nurses, and therefore I assume probably paramedics as well, haven't a clue what they would do if charged with the necessity of catheterising a trans woman. I know this because I have a correspondence from trans women who've actually been in that position, being unable to pee, having to take themselves to hospital because nobody seemed to know, where to put it. I hope that the ambulance services are going to actually work it out in case I ever need that help, because I might not be conscious to give instruction. Also, some emotional understanding. What makes trans people so sensitive about people knowing their past? Why is that such a big deal? What sort of relationships do trans people have? So that when you're dealing with next of kin, just as when dealing with the next of kin of LGB people, you don't put your foot in it. And it's also appreciating the kinds of fears that trans people historically have about medical personnel. Because if I've just described the experiences that people go through just to transition, there's not an awful lot of trust, I'm afraid, and it would be nice to try and rebuild some of that trust. So I'm sorry I've overrun a little bit. I tend to be a rather enthusiastic speaker, but it's a big subject, and it doesn't bite, does it? I've tried to be entertaining. I've tried to take a little bit of the heat off it, and I hope it's helped you a lot. I know I won't have covered it all today, but please, when you're thinking about your gender equality policies and schemes, don't miss out that bit, because it's very deliberately intended by the government that trans people are a part of that dimension. There aren't many of us, but you don't want to fail any of us, please. Thank you very much.